In Mark chapter 11 and verses 23 and 24, we have these words. I tell you the truth. If anyone says to this mountain, go, throw yourself into the sea, and does not doubt in his heart, but believes that what he says will happen, it will be done for him. Therefore I tell you, whatever you ask for in prayer, believe that you have received it, and it will be yours. I wonder whether those verses have ever bothered you as a Christian. It certainly bothered me in the past. And I've spoken to several Christian friends in the last few weeks, and they all say that these verses have, at one time or another, bothered them. I imagine these verses bother an awful lot of Christians. These verses say that whatever we ask, if we only would believe in our hearts that we've received it, then it will be ours. Even if we were to ask for a mountain to be thrown into the sea, if we only had enough faith, we could do it. And I wonder whether any of you have ever quoted that promise in your prayers. I wonder whether you've been so concerned about a particular situation that you've said to God, God, you promised that if I would believe in my heart that I've received the thing I'm praying for, that I will have it. Well, God, I do believe. I wonder whether you've ever prayed like that. But then, perhaps you didn't get the thing that you'd been praying for. And perhaps you blamed God. God, why didn't you keep your promise? Or, and I think this is far more likely, perhaps you beat yourself up. Perhaps you thought to yourself, I'm such a faithless Christian. If I had more faith, then I'd have the answer to my prayers. Well, about a year ago, I studied this passage with a small group of men who are far wiser than I am. And I came to understand this passage properly. And when I did, I realized there was no need for me to be beating myself up. And there was certainly no need for any Christian to be blaming God for not keeping his promises. And when I came to realize what was really being said in this passage, it was like a fog that had been lifted. And I could see things clearly. And it was such a huge relief to me. And because of the conversations I've had with other Christians, I think that there is a great deal of confusion surrounding these verses. And I hope to share some of my relief with you tonight, because I want you all to be free from any anxiety that you may have had over these verses. And by the end of this evening, I hope that you'll be able to read this passage as it was meant to be read. But in order to do that, let me just make 2 points by way of introduction. And the first point I want to make is this. We have to understand these verses in their right context. We have to understand the flow of what Mark is saying here. You know, one of the major reasons why we do get ourselves in a twist about problematic verses like these in the Bible is that we read them in isolation from everything else that surrounds it. And we shouldn't do that with the Bible. Now, Mark's gospel could be split into 2 halves, separated in the middle by Peter's confession on behalf of all the disciples that Jesus is the Christ. And before that central part, in the first half of Mark's gospel, Jesus performs many, many miracles to demonstrate that he really is the Messiah. And then Jesus says to them, after all these miracles, now who do you say that I am? And Peter says on behalf of all the disciples, yes, we believe you are the Christ. And after that time in Mark's gospel, Jesus concentrates much more on teaching his disciples that the messianic kingdom is going to be quite different from the one that they were expecting. For one thing, the Messiah must suffer and die. And they never expected that. And for another thing, this messianic kingdom will be a spiritual kingdom, not a geographical one. And they weren't expecting that. So how does that help us understand what we're looking at in Mark chapter 11, verses 23 and 24? Well, I'm saying we must read those verses in that context. These verses come in the second half of Mark's gospel, that section where Jesus is teaching the disciples that the messianic kingdom is quite different from the one that they were expecting. And somehow, some way, these verses relate to that context. But the second point of introduction I just want to make is this. We will understand verses 23 and 24 of Mark chapter 11 far better if we understand the numerous Old Testament references which are littered throughout this chapter. I was in London earlier this week, and I met a group of Dutch tourists from Alkmaar, and they were over in London to watch their football team play Arsenal in the European Cup. But they were out in London enjoying the sights, and they'd been wondering why everyone's walking around with these red poppies on their lapels. And they stopped me in the street, and they said to me, "Can we ask you, why are you wearing... Why is everybody wearing these red poppies?" And I said, "Well, it's a symbol of the poppy fields from Flanders in the First World War, and it's worn to remember those who died in that war and in every war since." Well, they all nodded their heads, and they said, well, they thought that that's what it was, but they just wanted to be sure. You see, they recognised the red poppy. They also recognised that it was coming up to November, and they recognised the time of year, and they guessed that it was all a reference to World War I, and they were right. You see, that's the power of that symbol. But it only worked because they knew that the battles of the First World War took place in fields that were very commonly populated by red poppies, and they knew enough about history to know that the war ended in November 1918. If they hadn't have known that, they would not have had a clue why everyone was walking around with these red poppies on the lapel. And one of the reasons that we don't notice all the symbolic references that are littered throughout Mark 11 is that, sadly, we don't know our Old Testament as well as we ought to know it. If we did, we would see them more clearly. We'd be able to understand the meaning, or at least say to ourselves, "Ooh, I wonder if that's a reference to such and such in the Old Testament." Just like those Dutch tourists who were walking around guessing that these red poppies were probably something to do with the First World War. And they were right. So those are my two points of introduction. We have to understand the context of this passage, and we have to understand the numerous Old Testament references that are in this passage. And with those two thoughts in mind, let us turn to the passage itself. And I want to look at Mark 11 under three headings: a proclamation, a problem, and a promise. Firstly, then, a proclamation. The events that we read of in Mark 11 are happening at the time of year, which was the Feast of Passover, that Jewish feast which remembered the time in Egypt when the blood of the lamb saved the firstborn Hebrew boys from the angel of death. The angel literally passing over those Hebrew homes where lamb's blood had been smeared onto the doorposts. And every year since then, Jewish families would travel up to Jerusalem, to the temple, to celebrate the feast of Passover. And the tradition was that the last bit of the journey should be taken on foot. Throngs of people walking up to the city of Jerusalem, singing psalms as they went. But not Jesus. Jesus isn't walking. Jesus is going to ride into the city on a colt, which is a young donkey. Now imagine you are a Jewish pilgrim of the first century. You're walking on one of the roads leading to the city of Jerusalem. It's a family occasion. You're in high spirits, you're singing psalms as you walk with all your family around you, and you're surrounded by hundreds of others of your countrymen, and you're all walking because that's the tradition. And remember that at this time, Palestine is under the occupation of the Roman forces, and you can imagine that a feast like Passover would be quite a patriotic time as well. You know, the Romans can take our palaces, they can take our lands, they could take our taxes, but they'll never take our Jewish traditions. You can almost feel the patriotic pride swelling up in their hearts as they walk towards their capital city. And there are days in the year when we feel the same sort of patriotic British pride as well, aren't there? Well, the same was true for the Jews, and Passover was quite probably one of those days. But imagine then you hear a commotion behind you. You turn around and you see a disturbance somewhere in the distance. You squint your eyes trying to figure out what is going on down there. And you realise that there's a party, a group, a melee coming up the road. And you see that one person is taller than everybody else. And he's not tall because he's tall in stature, but he doesn't seem to be walking. But every Jew walks up to Jerusalem at Passover time as part of our tradition. What is this person doing? And then as he gets nearer, someone nudges you in the ribs and says, "Hang on a minute, he's riding on something." "What's he riding on?" somebody else says. And as he comes nearer and nearer, you realise he's riding on a colt. And you look at each other and you smile at each other, because you're a first century Jew, you know what it means for someone to be riding on a colt coming in to Jerusalem. There's no doubt about it. Jesus is deliberately making a statement here. He's deliberately causing a stir. He's standing out like a sore thumb. But what is it that Jesus is saying here? What is it that he's proclaiming here? Well, he's proclaiming, "I am a king." It's an interesting fact that the kings of Israel didn't ride horses, because historically horses were seen to be symbolic of Egyptian strength, and a proper Jewish king ought not be seen on an Egyptian horse. Jesus isn't being humble here by riding on a donkey. He is in fact deliberately declaring, "I am a king. Not only am I a king, but I am a Jewish king. I am a king of Jews." And we know that this is what Jesus is saying because of the reaction of the crowd. The crowd recognize what Jesus is doing here. They all spread their cloaks on the ground just as they would for a king. And they shout a quote from Psalm 118. We read it together earlier. We sung it together earlier. And this was a psalm of victory, sung by a king who had triumphed over his foe when it looked like all hope had gone. And they wave palm leaves, which is something that they were supposed to do at the Feast of Tabernacles, not the Feast of Passover. So why are they waving these palm leaves at the wrong time of year? Well, because the Feast of Tabernacles remembers the wandering in the wilderness, and it celebrates the fact that Israel is now in the Promised Land. It symbolizes completion and rest, and is usually remembered at the time of year of full harvest. So what then is the crowd saying in Mark 11? It's saying the Messianic kingdom has come. And in fact, they add it to the quote. They quote from Psalm 118, where they say, "Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." That's the quote from Psalm 118. But they add something and they say, "Blessed is the coming kingdom of our father David." They think the Messianic kingdom has come. And then, of course, we couldn't refer to this riding in on a young donkey, a colt, without referring to Zechariah chapter 9, where in verses 9 and 10 we read these words. "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, daughter of Jerusalem. See, your king comes to you, righteous and having salvation, gentle and riding on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. I will take away the chariots from Ephraim and the war horses from Jerusalem, and the battle bow will be broken. He will proclaim peace to the nations. His rule will extend from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth." Do you see what we're saying here? We're saying that Jesus is deliberately causing a visual stir. He's deliberately proclaiming in the most visual way possible that he is the promised King of the Jews. Now the crowd has jumped to the conclusion, perhaps understandably, that the messianic kingdom has arrived. But are the crowds right to be so optimistic? This is Passover, not the Feast of Tabernacles. So we move on to our second point, a problem. From the very beginning of Mark chapter 11, Jesus is already hinting that all is not well in Israel. I don't know whether you ever noticed that this description of getting the colt from the village seems very labored, very wordy. Mark records Jesus telling his disciples that he wants them to go to the next village where they will find a colt, and the colt is tied up, and you're to untie that colt and to bring it to him. But then Mark records that the disciples did go to the village and they found a colt, and the colt was tied up, and they untied the colt. And then the people in the village says, "Why are you untying that colt?" You see, it all seems very laboured. Now, what does it matter whether this colt was tied up or not? Why not just rather say, "And Jesus rode into Jerusalem on a colt"? Mark's gospel is known for being very brief, very to the point. And a writer such as Mark would not waste his words unless the description itself has significance. And once more, if we knew our Old Testaments better, we would recognise the symbolism of a tied up donkey. If we were a first century Jew from Judea, we would recognise it just in the same way that a 21st century Dutchman recognises the symbolism of a red poppy. On hearing of a tied up donkey, a first century Jew from Judea would immediately think of that promise given by Jacob to his son Judah. And we read of that all the way back in Genesis chapter 49. Turn with me to Genesis 49. Here we have Jacob as an old man near the end of his life, and he is giving out blessings to his sons who become the head of the various 12 tribes of Israel. And in verse 10 of Genesis 49, Jacob speaks to his son Judah, and this is what he says: "The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he comes to whom it belongs, and the obedience of the nations is his. He will tether his donkey to a vine, his colt to the choicest branch. He will wash his garments in wine, his robes in the blood of grapes." Now, what is Jacob saying to his son, Judah, here? He's saying that one day, in Judah's tribe, from his family line, will come one who will rule forever. The scepter and the ruler's staff will never depart from him. All the nations will be his, and the land will be so prosperous and so abundant with grapes that the king would be able to tie a young colt to the best branch in his vineyard and not worry about it. Now, why would you be worried about tying a donkey to your best vine? Well, because what was donkey going to do if he sees a vine? He's going to start munching. He's going to start chewing and eating that lovely fruit. And what Jacob is saying is here, there will come a time when Israel is going to be so abundant with fruit that it's not going to bother you about tying up a colt to your best vine, because there's just going to be so much of it. So much of it that you will even wash your garments in wine, your robes in the blood of grapes, which is just another way of saying wine. Wine is a significant biblical symbol, a symbol of rest and completion. The first thing that Noah does when he comes out of the ark is to plant a vine. When the Jews are in the wilderness, they lack wine. But when the spies come back from the promised land, they bring back with them great bunches of grapes. Jesus refused to take wine on the cross because his work had not yet been done. And priests in the temple were never allowed to drink wine because their work was never done. You see, to a Jew from Judea, when he hears of a colt being tied up, he thinks of the promise given to Judah of an everlasting king coming to rule over the nations on earth and usher in a time of unparalleled prosperity and rest and completion. And that is why it is so significant here that Jesus, the real king of Judah, the true Messiah, tells his disciples to go to the village and untie the colt that is tied up there. In other words, Jesus is hinting here, this is not yet the time of prosperity and completion and fruitfulness in Israel. It is not yet the time of fruitfulness in Israel. And there's more in this passage that tells us not all is well in Jerusalem. After riding into the city on the colt, Jesus goes straight to the temple and he looks at everything. He examines everything that is going on there. He inspects everything. And by the time he's finished doing that, it's late in the day, and together with the 12, they leave the city and rest for the night in Bethany. And in the morning, they head back to the city, and on their way, they see a fig tree. And Jesus goes over to inspect the fig tree, just like he has inspected the temple. But there is no fruit on the fig tree. Now, there's no fruit on the fig tree because it's not the time for figs. If this had have been the time for the Feast of Tabernacles, it would have been the time of full harvest and the fig tree would have been full of fruit. But it's not the time for Feast of Tabernacles. It's not the time of rest and completion. This is the time of Passover. It is not the time of fruitfulness in Israel. Now, there are several passages throughout the Old Testament that speak of Israel in terms of being a fig tree. But for our purposes here, Micah 7 is a key passage for what we're thinking about. You don't need to turn to it, but in Micah 7, we see that a fruitful fig tree is symbolic of justice and righteousness. And in Micah 7, the writer says, I can't find any. I can't find any figs. And it goes on to talk about the lack of any justice and righteousness in Israel. Jesus was ravenous to find righteousness in the temple. He was ravenous to find justice in the temple, just in the same way as he was genuinely hungry for fruit on the fig tree. He was wanting to know what the old covenant had produced in Israel. And so when he finds the money changers, he's furious. And when he finds no fruit on the fig tree, he curses it. He proclaims it dead. And when Jesus turns over the tables of the money changers, he's not cleansing the temple. He's declaring that he's finished with this temple. He's rejected this temple. He is ending this temple. And Jesus quotes from Isaiah chapter 56 and verse 7. And he says, this place is supposed to be a house of prayer for all nations. And when we look at Isaiah 56, that whole chapter is about consummation. Jesus is saying, if Israel had been righteous, then the temple would be what it should be. But it isn't. In fact, it is a den of robbers. And calling the temple a den of robbers, he's quoting from Jeremiah chapter 7, verse 11. And in Jeremiah 7 and verse 20, a curse is pronounced upon the temple and upon the land, calling down the judgment of God upon the temple. And so Jesus, by quoting from Jeremiah 7, is effectively saying, I curse the fig tree because it's fruitless, and I curse the temple because it's fruitless. And the chief priests know exactly what Jesus is saying, and that is why they are so furious with him, and they want to kill him. Which is ironic, because in Jeremiah chapter 7 and verse 6, it says, if you do not shed innocent blood in this place, then I will let you remain here. And yet here are the chief priests, knowing full well that Jesus is quoting from Jeremiah 7. But they are planning to do precisely that, to shed Jesus' innocent blood. What we're saying is this: Jesus has pronounced himself king by riding into Jerusalem on a colt. But whereas the crowd think this is the dawn of the great messianic kingdom, Jesus says, no, there's a problem. I've inspected the temple and it's fruitless. Just as the fig tree has no fruit, so the temple has no justice and no righteousness. And he curses the tree and he curses the temple. In the morning, the disciples see the withered fig tree withered from the roots up. And we're meant to see it as a picture of the temple, as a picture of Israel, as a picture of the old covenant, rotten from the roots up. And so we move on, though, to our third point, a promise. The disciples, seeing the withered fig tree, are amazed. And Jesus replies to them, saying, in effect, they themselves will soon be doing even more amazing things than this. I tell you the truth. If anyone says to this mountain, go throw yourself into the sea, and does not doubt in his heart, but believes that what he says will happen, it will be done for him. Therefore I tell you, whatever you ask for in prayer, believe that you have received it, and it will be yours. Remember our two introductory points. Be aware of the structure of Mark and be aware of the Old Testament references. In the second half of Mark, Jesus is teaching his disciples that the messianic kingdom will not be established in the way they imagine it will be. And this reference to mountains being moved should have us all searching through our Old Testaments to see if there is any reference to this in connection with what is being discussed here in Mark 11. And there is an Old Testament reference to moving mountains, which is very much connected with what we've been thinking about in Mark 11. And it's found in the book of Zechariah. Zechariah was a prophet who was urging the Jews to rebuild the temple and the city after they'd returned from exile. The Babylonians had smashed the temple to pieces, but now, under the Persian Empire, they had been allowed to return home and rebuild the city and rebuild the temple. And under the leadership of Zerubbabel, that is what they were doing. But there were enemies set against them who wanted to frustrate their plans in rebuilding the temple. And in Zechariah chapter 4, Zechariah describes that opposition as a great mountain, a mountain of opposition to building the temple. And in Zechariah chapter 4 and verse 7, Zechariah says, what are you, O mighty mountain? Before Zerubbabel you will become level ground, and then he will bring out the capstone, meaning the completion stone or the cornerstone of the temple. He will bring out the capstone to shouts of God bless it, God bless it. That's what Zechariah says in chapter 4, verse 7 of Zechariah. Now, if we return then to Mark chapter 11, and verses 23 and 24, and read Jesus' words again, we begin to realize just what he is saying. Having just found the temple to be fruitless and full of corruption, and having just cursed it as dead as the fig tree, Jesus says to his disciples, if you have faith in God, if you believe in your heart, then you'll be able to remove the mountain of opposition to the building of the true temple, which is, of course, the church of Christ. He's saying here to his disciples that whenever and whatever you pray for regarding the building of the church, believe that you have received it and it will be yours. And indeed, God did keep that promise. Just think of Peter as one example of the disciples. When Jesus was arrested and taken away, Peter denied his Lord three times. When Jesus was hanging there on the cross, Peter was nowhere to be seen. We later come across Peter hiding with the other disciples, locked in a room, petrified of the Jewish religious leaders. But then look at Peter after Pentecost, with faith and belief oozing out of him. He preaches his heart out to the crowds in Jerusalem, and about 3,000 were added to the number that day. Was the mountain of opposition to the true temple being swept aside? Oh, you bet it was. And when Peter is arrested and dragged before the religious rulers, before the Sanhedrin, he boldly proclaims, "The stone you builders rejected has become the capstone." Jesus kept the promise. Have faith in God. I tell you the truth. If anyone says to this mountain, go throw yourself into the sea, and does not doubt in his heart, but believes that what he says will happen, it will be done for him. Therefore, I tell you, whatever you ask for in prayer, believe that you have received it, and it will be yours. Let's just summarize what we've been saying. In riding into Jerusalem on a colt, Jesus is proclaiming that he is King of the Jews. Now the crowd assumed that this ultimate Feast of Tabernacles had arrived, that all is now complete, that the Messianic kingdom is here. But Jesus examines the temple and finds no fruit, no righteousness, no justice, and he curses the old temple just like he cursed the fig tree. And he says, no, this isn't the time of the ultimate Feast of Tabernacles. This is the time for the ultimate Feast of Passover. The ultimate lamb's blood has yet to be shed. But once it is shed, and if the disciples would have faith, then that mountain of opposition to the building of the true temple will be swept aside. And the everlasting, all-glorious temple, which is the church, will be built with Jesus himself as the capstone. So please, don't ever beat yourself up over verses 23 and 24 of Mark chapter 11. These verses are not about prayer in general. If God doesn't answer your prayers, it is not because you're a weak and faithless Christian. These verses are about building the true temple, about building the true messianic kingdom. And God has kept that promise. And God is keeping that promise. The church is being built. And when I came to understand these verses properly, I felt utterly relieved, because I had been praying these promises to God, thinking that they referred to general prayer, and I had been beating myself up. And I'm sure that many Christians do the same. Well, I hope that now you feel the same relief that I felt when I first came to understand these verses. And I also felt something else. I felt ashamed that I didn't know the Old Testament better. I felt that I wanted to know the Old Testament better. And that's why it's been so wonderful to hear Dan preaching through Deuteronomy in the way that he has, and to hear Alan talking about the development of the temple in his midweek series. See, just like those Dutch tourists being able to spot a poppy and being able to understand what it meant and make a guess about what it meant and to be right about what it meant As Christians, we should be reading our New Testaments, and every time we see symbolism from the Old Testament, we should be able to know it and ask ourselves, I wonder if, and then to look at the Old Testament and to be right. And when I came to understand these verses properly, it also caused me to praise God for his reliability. We should never turn to God and say, you have promised, but where is the promise? Because he has kept the promise. The very fact that we're meeting here this evening is evidence that the temple has been built, is being built. We have a trustworthy God who, when he says he will do something, will do it. Well, I hope you feel the same way too. Amen. We take our hymn books and sing together hymn number 456, a hymn that very much relates to this passage. Give me the faith which can remove and sink the mountain to a plain. Give me the childlike praying love which longs to build thy house again. Hymn number 456.